Hi, thanks for downloading and listening to the 4 Million Years Later podcast. This is a show where a couple of old friends get together and watch an episode of the Generation 1 Transformers cartoon in story order, then convene to talk about what they saw, looking at it from the perspective of children who grew up with the show, never fell out of love with it, and then kind of comparing that perspective to what do we think about it as adults. My name is Jersey Drozd. I'm a cartoonist and teaching artist, and the other host is named...
Hoover.
He's back. Good to hear from you again, Hoover.
Good to be back.
Now, I led with an introduction that suggests we're going to talk about an episode of the Transformers, but I think probably from the title, people have inferred that that ain't what we're doing this week.
This week, much like the last episode, is a little different. We're not talking about an episode in particular. We're talking about characters we've met so far in Season 2. And last week, we talked about the Earth-based Autobots that popped up in Season 2. And this episode, we're going to talk about the few Autobots that we met in space, as well as the new Decepticons. There were so many Autobots, we had to bump them to a second episode.
Yeah, there's like a real disparity this season between introducing new Autobots. And it's like, I point once again to that commercial that announced all the new Autobot toys and Decepticon toys coming in Season 2, where it's like Optimus has his hands full introducing all the new characters. Then it's like, and Megatron introduces his new Decepticons, Thrust and Dirge. Oh. It's like, that Season 2 kind of is a ripoff for the Decepticon fans. And it was, I guess it was the same way in Season 1. Like, was the disparity quite as extreme? I think it was in Season 1, wasn't it? There was, like, a lot of Autobot cars, and then it's like, well, here's your five Decepticons. Enjoy!
There's always been more Autobots than Decepticons, but Season 2, the ratio got even worse.
Yeah, it really did.
There's literally only five new Decepticons in Season 2 before the episodes that we haven't yet watched. We're doing this now because we're about to get inundated with both new Autobots and Decepticons, so...
Okay. So, yeah, it's a good opportunity to take a break and, like, sort of assess everybody we've met so far, share our thoughts, like, in a focused way, how we feel about everybody, and maybe, time willing, talk a little bit about, you know, how Season 2 is shaking out in terms of tone. But where do you want to start, Hoover? You said we're going to talk about Autobots in space. Who are we starting with?
Well, let's start with that Autobot bounty hunter that we saw in one episode. Let's talk about DevCon.
I am a bounty hunter searching for Decepticons who must be brought to justice. I have followed three of them here to Sheol. Astrotrain, Dirge, and Ramjet. Have you seen them?
Yeah, talk about DevCon. How do you feel about DevCon? I have to imagine that you have some affinity for the character. One, bounty hunter. You have a history of liking bounty hunters. And two, John Stevenson. I've never known you to dislike a John Stevenson character.
That's very true. I think he's a very interesting character. Just the fact that he's a bounty hunter Autobot. Mm-hmm. You know, like Star Wars taught us that bounty hunters are above the law and they're reckless and they work for the bad guys.
Well, they work for whoever pays their price.
Right. And to have a Autobot who is typically, you know, a good guy, a moral character, to have him be a bounty hunter, that just begs a lot of questions. And in the one episode he appears in, The Gambler, we don't get an answer to those questions. So it's interesting. I'd love to know more. I would have liked to see him again. You know, I just think it's an interesting concept that deserved a little bit more meat on that bone.
Mm.
And I think his voice is great, of course.
Yeah, yeah. He's at the, like, if you're going to do somebody who's been alone for a long time and traveling the galaxy looking for people, because like he says in The Gambler, he's been tracking down, I think, Ramjet and Astrotrain, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's been looking for them. Having that grisly John Stevenson voice is like a perfect choice. You don't want Dan Gilveson playing a bounty hunter.
No.
Hi.
No.
I've been hunting these people for a long time, but gosh, it's awful lonely. Or like Chip Chase. You don't want him playing that character, right?
No. It was a good choice to use John Stevenson.
For sure. And believe it or not, like, I don't know what you thought. I took separate notes for this. And like, I don't know what you were expecting me to bring to the table is, but I actually have like a couple Santa Claus-sized bags of thoughts on DevCon.
Go for it.
Because I was thinking about, like, what is this character? Like, I feel like DevCon is, like, a real pivot point in the series in a lot of ways. Like, so one, in the first season of the Generation 1 Transformers series, we got to see Cybertronian modes for Autobots and Decepticons alike, but their robot modes were largely what we knew as the toys. Even the Rainmakers, when they're in robot mode, they look like Starscream, Thundercracker, and Skywarp, the toys that we have that turn into F-16s or F-15s, whatever they are, right? So DevCon shows up, and this is the first time we see a Cybertronian robot who hasn't scanned anything on Earth, right? His vehicle mode feels like vanilla Cybertronian. Like, this is your basics. And I don't mean vanilla in like a disparaging way. I mean like this is genuinely Cybertronian vehicle mode, genuinely Cybertronian robot mode. And when you look at him, you can see how we're getting to the season 3 Transformers the movie sort of robots. He's much more simplified in color scheme. He's got the Florodairy swooshes going on all over him and like the whimsical stuff, like the thing on his head, right? He doesn't look as boxy as the other Earthbound Autobots. You put him right next to Smokescreen, you see that there's something more whimsical in his design in terms of the lines and the shapes that are used. But then there's something much more simplified in the approach of, like, he's just blue and white, whereas Smokescreen, red, white, and blue. A lot of the Autobots have like at least three colors on them, right? So maybe I'm overthinking this, but I feel like this is the moment. Like, the moment we meet DevCon is where it's like things are now, the timeline has skewed, and we are no longer going to be seeing as many boxy Autobots. We're going to start getting much more swooshy, Florodairy style characters. And one of the first things you notice in Transformers the movie is that, like, wow, the Autobots are much more color schemed. Blur has like a much more, he's a cooler color scheme. Hot Rod is a warmer color scheme. Springer is the, you know, the green with like a little bit of yellow, but you don't get as much of, I guess now that I'm thinking a little bit more about it, Sunstreaker and Sideswipe had like a pretty like simplified color scheme, but there's at least three colors on almost every character in season one, right? Even the Constructicons, you have the green, purple, and silver, right? So I just feel like DevCon is like the first like sort of like native Cybertronian look, even though he's been, you know, off-world hunting Decepticons in deep space. It also introduces this idea that Cybertron isn't the only place you can find Autobots and Decepticons. The fact that Autobots and Decepticons are on Earth is not a unique thing. DevCon is evidence that at least some Autobots have left the world, not necessarily to be colonists, although that could be. At least this one is traveling the universe. So even though we didn't notice it as children, how could we have? We didn't know where things were going. The fact that later on we'll meet some more Cybertronians who didn't go to Earth in future episodes, they have the same sort of design language that DevCon has. So he's worth looking at for that reason. And did we ever get a figure of DevCon?
To my knowledge, there's been absolutely no figure ever made of DevCon, be it before the Masterpiece era or after. And I think has really surprised me. I mean, they've made literally just about everyone, but he has somehow escaped.
And I really want to see a story that I want to see somebody tell a story of DevCon and Slizardo in deepest space trying to make ends meet. You know, that seems like it seems like there might be an audience for that, right? Right? If you could do The Mandalorian, why can't you do DevCon? That's the Generation 1 sort of like tangential storyline I really want to see, especially with Slizardo. So, yeah, that's what I got on DevCon. I think he's fascinating as a character. He's, like you said, he's an Autobot who doesn't fit the stereotype that what we've been considering Autobots to be so far. And he also represents this sort of fulcrum point where things start to shift overall in the Transformers narrative, whether they meant it or not.
Yeah, I agree. Because where it falls in season 2, it's kind of towards the end. It's a little past the middle of season 2, I believe. It's almost like our first taste of, hey, kids, start to get used to this sort of art style and design style for characters, because you're going to be seeing a lot more of this very soon. So with DevCon, they start introducing this sort of, I wouldn't say new look, but almost like a new sort of design, behind the characters. And from DevCon, we go to the female Autobots that we get introduced to in the search for Alpha Trion. And they continue that very Cybertronian aesthetic that we haven't really seen so far, because we've mainly seen Decepticons, or rather the big, dumb, bubbly robots that Shockwave had to get out of a closet.
Right. And I feel like Shockwave is like a good middle ground between like the DevCon and female Autobot aesthetic and Megatron, right? He's a little swooshy, still boxy, you know, he looks like he belongs in Cybertron. But yeah, when you start getting into these new characters, that these Autobots in space, they all feel more lithe and curvy. So yeah, let's talk about the female Autobots. Who do you want to start with?
Well, let's start with the boss, Alita One.
Welcome back, Autobots. Congratulations on a mission well done.
She was voiced by Marlene Aragon, and as we discussed in the search for Alpha Trion, she has a very leaderly voice, I guess I would say. She sounds very much in charge of things.
It's very rich. Her voice is layered, and it's rich, and it feels like you would hear her over a crowd, right? I have friends whose voices are like exactly in the decibel space or in the tonal space of like, if you're in a crowded room, you can't hear them at all. But her voice would carry over a bunch of other voices. It has like a richness to it. And like we talked about in the search for Alpha Trion, it almost feels like it's echoing the same kind of vocal presence that Optimus Prime has.
Mm-hmm.
So she feels like she's like a counterpart to him in that way, as well as romantically, which they were pretty unambiguous about, that there's like a romantic connection between her and Optimus. But she leads the female Autobots on Cybertron. Weird that the Resistance is all female and it's all led by her. I won't go into it again, Hoover. I promise. I'm not going to dig into that. But just focusing on the character herself, I think her design is really cool. The helmet's a little on the weird side. There's times where it's drawn differently, and I feel like, okay, well, when you add a little bit more curved geometry to it instead of just like it being like this flat sort of like almost Mayan headdress, it looks kind of cool. But I'll tell you one thing I wish we would have gotten more of with Alita One in this series, because I don't know if we ever see her again. I don't think we do. I wish we would have seen more of her vehicle mode. Because Optimus's vehicle mode feels like it has a presence, right? It's a big truck. And we see her vehicle mode for a few seconds in the search of Alpha Trion. And I just wish we could have seen a little bit more just to see like what kind of, I don't know, maybe this is once again me reading into it too much. But I feel like her vehicle mode should have had, in the way that she echoes Optimus, her vehicle mode should echo Optimus's vehicle mode. But it really feels like she's just kind of a Cybertron streetcar kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like a lot of the Cybertron Transformers tend to be. I guess that'd be my only regret about her in terms of character design. I have tons of regrets about the character in terms of the way she was approached in the narrative, but I also have a lot of positive feelings too. I love the fact that she is this sort of feminine echo of Optimus.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. How do you feel about her, generally speaking?
Well, I mean, she really fulfills that role in that episode, and unfortunately, we never really get to revisit, you know, she's another character that we don't see again. Well, we do kind of, because they're, spoiler alert, there's going to be a flashback episode, so we're going to get, we're going to get a small taste of her again, but in a different way, and I don't want to say much about it, because we'll deal with that when we get to it. But I think as far as a leader goes on Cybertron, she was portrayed as a good leader, and she had a lot of good skills that made you want to see the character again. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, it just never happened.
Yeah, that's another thing to bring up, is that she also really symbolizes, if DevCon shows like this point where the series starts to shift towards more of a futuristic Cybertronian kind of look, she introduces this moment where the lore is starting to get expanded on. Up until this point, the lore was all being developed on Earth, a little bit on Cybertron in terms of the space bridge and stuff, but most of like the development of the series was happening on Earth. Now we see, okay, there's backstory. Well, Secret of Omega Supreme, we got a little bit of that too, right? We found out there's this thing called Guardian Robots. But I feel like this is an important moment where suddenly we're getting more history, more backstory, and the and revealing backstory that we had no access to otherwise. And I feel like that's another thing that gets left on the floor in season two, which kind of bums me out, is, yeah, you just showed that she's incredible and that Optimus has, like, powerful big feelings about her. Why do we ever see her again? Mm-hmm. Why can't she be in Transformers the movie and in season three? Because, you know, we get more quote-unquote female Autobots in season three. Why not Alita? It's disappointing. So yeah. I don't know what the internal discussion was about that. But, I mean, she has since become, in the later iterations of the series, a pretty important character. Mm-hmm. So,
and all the girls finally got toys in the last few years.
Yeah. I guess that would be the last button I'd put on this character, and I would say this for all the female Autobots in Season 2, is there is that unfortunate aspect where they all have this very stereotypical, idealized, in air quotes, female form, where they're very lithe and thin and curvy at the waist and all that stuff. And we had a discussion in the Search for Alpha Trion about other female Transformers characters who show up later who we think are, like, represent a broader spectrum of what femininity can look like, and that's to be celebrated. These all these female Autobots we're talking about right now all did get toys, but there's that unfortunate side effect where, like, they just have all this junk on their back.
Yeah.
In order to, like, be able to have them turn into a car at all. So Barbie doll with a giant backpack. So, but at the same time, it's like, well, I want it to look like the cartoon version that I grew up with. So it's, once again, with Alita 1 and all the female Autobots, I am just a swirling mess of cognitive dissonance. But I love the character, and I love that story, despite the big problems that I have with it. So who else is on our list?
There's Chromia, voiced by Linda Gary.
Mm-hmm.
Hold it, Ironhide. Ladies first.
And there's Firestar, voiced by Morgan Lofting.
The last thing I saw on the monitor were some Decepticons, right above our headquarters.
Moonracer, voiced by Morgan Lofting.
We came close to getting vaporized. It was all my fault, Alita.
Everybody's voiced by Morgan Lofting. I never noticed that until you pointed out to me that Firestar and Moonracer are the same person. So good on you, Morgan Lofting, for having range. You could be the Baroness, and you could be Moonracer.
Well, that's just assuming that IMDb is correct. I mean, I couldn't tell it. I mean, they seem distinct. It wasn't a case of it's the exact same voice, but I have to assume it's correct.
I certainly didn't realize that Chromia was Linda Gary. I mean, and I have gone back and listened a couple times, like, trying to figure out, where is it that I'm hearing? What am I hearing in there that sounds close to what I've heard from her before? Because, like, her sorceress Teela and Queen Marlena are close enough that you can hear the similarities.
Right.
This Chromia feels, like, just distinct enough. I'm like, okay, maybe it's the vocal processing. I don't know. But so let's talk about them. Chromia, you know, there's not a lot. We have to do a lot of inferring from, like, very, very thin material here. Design wise, I love that she's got the popped collar. That feels so incredibly 80s. I love her performance. She has a terrific, strong voice. She feels like a lieutenant. She feels like she'd get along with Prowl really well.
Mm-hmm. She seems to be sort of like the officer in charge in the field, whereas Alita 1's usually back at base, you know, calling the shots. Mm-hmm. She is the sort of the Duke.
There you go. Yeah. Yeah, and her performance kind of feels that way, too. It feels very Michael Bell-ish.
Mm-hmm.
Feels like the feminine reflection of Michael Bell's presence in a character. So that's great. Yeah, of these new characters, I would say, of the three sort of characters we follow, besides Alita 1 in the Search for Alpha Trion, she was my favorite of the three. What about you?
Well, I think we could probably both agree that we didn't get a lot out of Firestar.
That's right.
So it's, like, hard to judge what she really brings to the table other than she transforms real good and can haul Energon.
Yeah.
But what I really enjoy about these characters, the one I like the most, I think, is Moonracer, specifically because they call her out for being essentially like a sniper character.
Yeah.
She's good with aim and guns. And that's interesting because obviously this is coming from a very stereotyped time. But if you have to create a sniper character or a character who's really good with weapons, you wouldn't assume back then that it would have been female. So I like that sort of breaking of the stereotypes with her.
Yeah.
And that potentially she's a better shot with a gun than any of the Autobots we already know. I mean, we see that cool shot that she makes when she collapses that tower onto Ramjet and Rumble. So I wish we could have seen more things like that, because it's too often that when the Autobots and Decepticons get into a laser fight, they're just standing on opposite sides. No one's hitting anyone. But I want to see more action of Moonracer, like taking these ridiculous shots, like behind her head, like Lieutenant Falcon was trying to do in G.I. Joe the movie when he almost shot his stepbrother.
Hey, spoilers.
Like, I want to see more fun things like that with Moonracer, where she's collapsing towers onto dumb seekers.
Yeah, she's got like an Annie Oakley thing going on with her, where she's like this cheerful, like high-spirited sharp shot.
Mm-hmm.
You could do some fun battle scenes with that kind of character, jumping all over the place and like just casually going pew 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 pew, and like oh, she shot Rumble's feet out from under him, and now he's laying on his back. She shoots Megatron in the butt, and he's like, stop it, you know? That kind of thing would be super fun to see in an episode. Unfortunately, we never see Moonracer again either.
Yeah.
So it's astonishing to me that these characters, they really do resonate. We feel, we remember them clearly when we think about this episode.
Mm-hmm.
We react emotionally when we see them, and it's just like, wow, you didn't do anything with them after that? Yeah, Alita 1, okay. Got a couple other iterations, but never to see Moonracer or Chromia again. Wow, that's surprising. I don't actually. Somebody's gonna come at me. I'm maybe in one of those new versions of Transformers where they're aiming at grown-ups. They brought those characters in, so perhaps I haven't seen them. But I'm specifically talking about kids' show iterations of the series, because those are the ones I gravitate toward.
Yeah, and specifically, we're talking about the original cartoon, how they never came back. So
yeah, especially when, you know, a main character in season 3 was a female Autobot. So, come on, give us some other ones in there, too. That would be nice. But not to be.
Yeah.
So, yep, they point to something really great, and we only got 21 minutes with them, which is unfortunate.
Mm-hmm. Now, as far as the rest of the Autobots over on Cybertron, we would be remiss to not talk about Alpha Trion.
Only your design will properly interface with Alita 1.
He is voiced by John Stevenson as well.
Yeah.
Very wise sounding John Stevenson.
Especially in season 2. His performance tends to be, I would say, his late 60s, early 70s, wizened old man.
Mm-hmm.
Season 3, when we hear from him a little bit, or maybe it's season 4. No, it's season 3. He brings it up an octave, and he sounds a little bit more frail, which is interesting.
Mm.
But in this, yeah, you're right. He's wise, old, grandfatherly Ben Kenobi kind of figure in the series. Although, I think when we see him again a little bit later on, he's also got a little bit of like the when Luke first meets Yoda kind of vibe going on, where he's kind of a goof as well. But I want to back away for a second and hear how you feel about Alpha Trion before I talk about what I think he represents for me.
Well, again, I think they're really playing on the Ben Kenobi sort of role for him. Because, I mean, season 1, the Autobots didn't have anything like this. They were just, you know, a team of characters, and there was no wise old wizard sort of stereotype among them. Not at all. And so then in season 2, they sort of like start to fill out the backstory, and they introduce this wise old Autobot that is pretty mysterious. You know, we never see him transform. We don't know anything about the character until the other characters start talking about him. So we have to learn about him that way. You know, the first time we hear about him, Alita 1 is like, I'll talk to Alpha Trion and
he'll
blah,
know what
blah.
To do.
Yeah. So that's sort of an interesting new addition to the franchise, to have that type of character be involved. And we'll see him again in season 2. So we will get a little more out of him,
mm-hmm.
unlike the girls here. But
yeah,
it's definitely an interesting new, not wrinkle exactly, but an interesting new thing to inject into the series, to have this sort of wise old man who everyone sort of looks up to.
Mm-hmm. And it's unambiguously hinted in The Search for Alpha Trion that he, quote-unquote, created Optimus Prime and Alita One, which I didn't realize when we were recording the episode. Doesn't that make them siblings? Okay, that's even more weird. But I want to grab onto this word weird and hang on to it for a second. Because like something that I think we were celebrating in Season 1, maybe me more than you, I don't know, is this idea of sort of unexplained whimsy, right? The fact that you have made almost a career out of rationalizing some of the weirdest stuff in the series, like the origin of Reflector. Well, if you look,
when this is the worst paying career ever.
There's no benefits. But like you've spent decades rationalizing all of these weird inconsistencies in the series, which I have often celebrated as like, yeah, that's the weirdness that made this thing sort of extra compelling for me, like in this weird kind of hippie way. Or to quote Blaster in Autobop, it's like it gives the place atmosphere to have the weirdos in here. And so I feel like Alpha Trion is a great big push in the direction of like, let's make the mythology weirder again. Let's introduce the idea of like, yeah, you can have really old Autobots and like they have beards. What? Mm-hmm. That doesn't even make any sense. Why would they have long facial hair? And the fact that there's like, you know, these creatures are millions and millions of years old. Why would they even be showing age in that way? And what is it with Alpha Trion's face where it looks vaguely more human than everybody else's? He's got like this weird kind of earthiness to him. Earthiness, when I mean like of the earth, like ancient and old and mysterious, but they make him look more organic to get there. I think that's fascinating, and it cries for explanation. And I don't want it explained. Just like I never want to see Orko's face, and I don't want to know Sergeant Slaughter's real name. These kinds of mysteries are part of what makes this thing like extra kind of compelling to me, and it like helps suspend my disbelief in having a little bit of weird banana stuff in the background. I don't necessarily want all the continuity explained and justified to me, right? So the fact that he comes out of nowhere, and the fact that he looks like that, and the fact that everybody seems to revere him, but they don't tell us why. I love it. I absolutely love it. Keep my Transformers kind of weird. So I really do. I enjoy Alpha Trion as a character. I like what he represents. I like that there is somebody, quote unquote, potentially wiser than Optimus to turn to. I like that he's shown up in later iterations of the series, too. I mean, he was in Transformers Prime, and he looked pretty darn close to how he looked in this. So I like Alpha Trion a lot, but I am eager, before we spend too much time on this, to talk about some Decepticons, Hoover. What do you say?
Well, that does wrap up all the Autobots in space that we've met so far. So moving on to the Decepticons, of which there are only 5 new additions this season. And no, I'm not counting Deceptitran.
I was going to say.
I'm not counting Bubblehead and all those strange robots that Shockwave orders around. Forget that.
No Lord Gaikini.
No. No squishies this episode.
Okay.
So starting out with Dirge, voiced by Bud Davis.
Ramjet, I have the creepy feeling we're being monitored.
Now, Dirge is kind of interesting to me because he's the one Seeker that I never had until they did those Toys R Us reissues from the early 2000s.
Wow.
So for the longest time, I had 5 of them, but not Dirge. So that was a momentous occasion to finally get a new Dirge, brand new in the box, to see it at Toys R Us. That was fun.
That was a good time.
But as far as the character goes, it's kind of hard to read. He's obviously weird. For these guys, these new Decepticons here, I was browsing the tech specs, and so I want to read from his. Dirge says, "The sound of his engines causes petrifying fear in those who hear them. He's a master at handling fear. Other Decepticons are put off by his mournful, silent ways. He gives me the creeps, says Ramjet. Needs to control a situation, otherwise he too falls victim to fear, making him useless as a warrior. Now that's interesting. It's an interesting bio. Now how that translated to the show, it does, but I mean, everything Dirge says is like talking about dread or like has
Let's
that sort
teach
of
them the meaning of sorrow.
Mm-hmm. It's like there's like a dark tone to it all. And as far as his delivery goes, he's just talking like this. And like, you can't have a mournful type personality if you sound like Thrust. You know, Dirge, voiced by Bud Davis, he's just like, rah, rah, rah. Even, you know, even in The Gambler, when he's scared of DevCon showing up, he still has that sort of like, rah, rah, sort of.
Mm-hmm. Like Lurch from the Addams Family.
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder if that was a partial inspiration for that voice.
Yeah.
But again, this is a voice actor who has like next to nothing in their IMDb. So if anyone knows the backstory of Bud Davis or how he got involved in the Transformers franchise, I would love to know.
Mm-hmm.
But another thing I found really interesting on Dirge's tech specs, and again, tech specs are something that the writers either seem to pay close attention to or just ignore completely. So it doesn't always translate to their role in the show. But Dirge has an intelligence of 8 out of 10.
Hmm.
It just makes me think of like when you're in school and there's that like weird goth kid in class, but it turns out he's like super smart. And it's like he does his homework because it's easy for him. He doesn't give the impression of paying attention in class, probably because he already thinks he knows everything the teacher is saying. So it's weird to have a seeker with that level of intelligence when it doesn't seem to correspond to his rank, because all the 3 Coneds have a rank of 5. And that's pretty much typical for your everyday Decepticons. But Dirge's intelligence is 8 and his skill is 9. So obviously the intent with Dirge was some kind of, you know, intelligent type of, I don't want to say leader because he only has a rank of 5 like everyone else, but that's a weird combo of stats to be so intelligent and so skilled, but a low rank. What does that mean? It's almost like, again, it makes me think of like a goth kid in class who's not very interested in being there, maybe because he's, you know, so smart and already knows all the stuff. And if he would apply himself, he could be amazing because of that skill 9, but he doesn't apply himself. So he only ends up with a rank of 5. It's almost like when someone graduates from college and then like goes to work at McDonald's. That's what it makes me think of. So it's a weird mix. And I think it's very interesting to have a Conehead with such a weird mix of stats like that. And plus his courage is only 4.
Well, that's just it. So when I, as we're continuing this thought experiment, like what could they have done with Dirge? It's like intelligence 8, skill 9, courage 4 says to me, you put those together and you get somebody who is highly skilled, highly intelligent, but intelligent enough to know that if he flaunts it, he's going to be more responsible for stuff. His courage isn't that high. I don't want to be in charge of anything.
Yeah.
But I have a rich understanding. Like I imagine, like if we were writing Dirge today, like in like a Transformers animated episode, he would be into poetry, not like Skybite, not necessarily like, oh, I'm going to write a limerick, but like he'd be like into like, you know, the troubadours and like also like dark poetry. Like he'd be like all into Poe and things like that. He'd be super emo.
Yeah.
And again, intelligence means that you can have a rich understanding of things, but he would have a rich understanding of like these, like very like these siloed sort of things where, and I think about that line, he gives me the creeps, says Ramjet. There would be scenes, and this is another thing we can observe about season 2 as a whole, is that we don't get a lot of scenes where the Decepticons are like just like hanging out and talking to each other, like Reflector and Thundercracker standing on a hill talking to each other, or Rumble and Skywarp in the ice tunnel just giving each other the business.
Yeah.
We don't get that as much. And I feel like if we had a scene where we get personality through the voice performance and the whole, like, that's teaching the meaning of sorrow. But when do we get to see Dirge in the bass and he walks by and, you know, like Rumble and Frenzy are playing cards or something. He's like, what's the point of anything? Win, lose, it's all a game and then we die. And then he walks by and then, like, you have Rumble and Frenzy look at each other and, like, shudder. Like, ugh, hate yeah. that guy. He's always yeah. walking around with bad news coming out of his mouth, you know? Like, he doesn't feel, I don't want to say vampiric, but I want to say, like, that kind of, like, and emo is not the right word either, because emo is, mm-hmm. like, it's not a phase, Dad.
And but, plus, emo is more sad. Dirge doesn't seem sad, even though his name mm-hmm. sort of implies that.
But just,
I mean,
like,
he just seems like he's more
gloomy and obsessed with darkness.
Yeah.
That's how I would read him.
Pessimistic.
Yeah, there you go. And you know, it says he's a master of handling fear. So he thinks about gloomy, dark things so much that it's second nature to him. He has like 1,000 ways to like bring out the fear in you until he gets afraid because his courage is really low.
Mm-hmm.
So once you got him afraid, then he falters. That's a great idea for a character. He was always written as kind of a dum-dum, though. So
yeah. His portrayal on the show does not make you think, oh, he must be really intelligent. Not at all. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, he was sort of, excuse the expression, thrust into this concept
Ooh.
Where they're basically, you know, the Three Stooges. So, you know, he can't mm-hmm. really show intelligence in that role. So, again, I think that's a case where the show just sort of ignored that sort of statistic and was just like, well, these guys are dummies. I don't want to make him an 8 intelligent kind of guy.
Well, to be fair to the writers, too, one of the things that we've often said, and I'll just bring it up again, is we don't know how much Hasbro was involved in some of these creative choices, right?
Mm-hmm.
Many of the writers have reported that Hasbro kind of said, like, do something about this toy. We want to move a lot of that one.
Yeah.
So given that there's only 5 new Decepticons, my guess is Hasbro wasn't coming in there going, like, we got to move some more Dirges. Do a story about Dirge.
Mm-hmm.
No, just make sure that all of those jets show up at some point. Have a thing fall on them. It's fine. Kids will want to get the toys because they're on the TV.
Yeah, I think just the fact that they're bad guys, I mean, it doesn't allow for a lot of room for character development in a show like this, which is unfortunate because it's what I love. But, you know, it's just not how it went. I mean, we're lucky we got the sort of loud personalities of Rumble and Skywarp and stuff. But going beyond that and, like, having an episode where they explain that Dirge is a smart character, you know, they're not gonna go that far,
mm-hmm.
unfortunately. I would have really liked that.
Yeah.
But there's just not really a lot of room for it in the show.
Yeah. And like you've pointed out many times, hey, where did they come from? We never get origin stories of these characters.
Mm-hmm.
So could have even had something where, boy, wouldn't it have been interesting if Dirge was, like, somebody who just had something, he has some kind of past trauma that makes him so, like, sort of gloom and death obsessed.
Yeah, and like I've said numerous times before, I think it would have been great had these new Seekers shown up and, like, literally they were stars and they basically took the jobs of the last 3 Seekers, and Skywarp and Thundercracker and Starscream were all resentful. And you could have had Dirge be the boss of Ramjet and Thrust, you know, with that intelligence score. And they could have played it up to where these guys were like the new exciting thing and Megatron loved them. And the old guys were just like we said before, much like a Skybite versus Scourge thing from Robots in Disguise. That would have been really fun. But
it would have been fun.
Didn't happen. And I think of these 3 Coneheads, I think Dirge got the least exposure in the show. And we were left with probably the most questions about Dirge out of the 3. It's just left up in the air because we do see them again in season 3, but not much. They're just sort of around and they just sort of blend into the background.
Yeah, it's only going to get worse for the Decepticons from here on out.
Mm-hmm.
There's going to be some, like, a few stars of the Decepticon team, but then everybody else is just like, you're a soldier. You don't really have anything to do here.
Yeah.
My closing thought on Dirge is that when I was a kid, I would look up things that I didn't know in the dictionary. And when I saw the name Dirge, I was like, well, is that like a dodge? Is that like some kind of, like, plane maneuver?
Mm.
I looked it up and I'm like, oh, it's like a funeral song? There's like a guy who's named after a funeral song? Wow, he must be creepy as all get out, you know? And I read his tech spec, and I'm like, oh my gosh, he is, because I didn't have the toy, but I did have the Transformers Universe sort of collection of profiles of all the different Transformers that Marvel Comics mm-hmm. produced. So it was very intriguing to me. And then you watch them in the show and it's like, okay, well, I'm getting a little bit of that, I guess. But again, it feels like they were only half paying attention to it or only half-heartedly interested in exploring that. It was an aspect of his character, but it wasn't the center part of his character. I would love to have seen how Dirge would have been interpreted in a season one episode.
Mm-hmm.
That would have been cool.
I agree. Well, moving on from him to Ramjet, who's voiced by Jack Angel.
You so brave now! Too bad your courage does not hold up under fire!
Ramjet's a bit more sort of obvious as far as the type of character he is. And maybe that's not the right way to put it because I am still left with a lot of questions about him. But let's see what his tech spec says. It says, mid-air collisions are his specialty. It makes little difference if the target is an opponent or not. He'll crash into it just for the fun of bringing terror to the skies. These crashes can take their toll on him, particularly doing damage to his internal mechanisms. The skies are my castle, and I like to live alone, he says. So that's definitely a good starting point, and we definitely see that. He definitely does, like, mid-air ramming in the show. And in a Decepticon Raider in King Arthur's court, he crashes into things a couple times, I feel like. It's like, hey, kids, do you understand that this guy likes to ram things? His name is Ramjet. So they were a little more on the nose and obvious with him. But just the way Jack Angel voices him is very interesting and unusual. I can only think of one time he used a contraction when he said, "Stop it, Dirge. There's nothing here but sand and more sand." That's the one time I heard a contraction come out of his mouth. So he's usually like speaking in a very odd way. And I guess that was just maybe Jack Angel trying to differentiate him from his other roles on the show. But again, you know, these three did not get a lot of backstory at all. So we don't really know that much about them, and they just speak like they speak and so on.
You know, we have to infer a lot based on the performance because we don't get a lot in the script.
Mm-hmm. And turning to the tech specs, we see that Ramjet has an intelligence of 5. So that's pretty middle of the road. A little on the low side. But his courage is 8. So that I can see tying into mid-air collisions. Like, he's not afraid to potentially damage himself. In fact, he likes it. So I can see that applying to his courage. His skill is 6, so that's just sort of like, okay. So I could see that affecting his rank, which is only 5, but all 3 of the Coneheads have that 5 rank. So it doesn't feel like there's a whole lot to him as a character. Whereas with Dirge in comparison, it seems like they could have told a lot more stories based on the tech spec. Whereas with Ramjet, he's like, oh yeah, he rams stuff. Well, that's not a lot.
He's played as a heavy throughout. And reading his tech spec, I mean, that doesn't seem like they did a lot of interpretation there. It seems like intelligence 5, courage 8, skill 6, plus what they say about, like, he likes to crash into things. Everything about it reads like, okay, yep, he's a heavy. The thing is his, in his performance in the series and the way his dialogue is written, is like, it's not 100% clear all the time what kind of heavy they want him to be. So in a Decepticon Raider in King Arthur's court, I remember us talking about how he kind of comes off as like the character who'd be like guarding the entrance to the nightclub. He's in a suit and he's ready to mix it up if you push him. He doesn't want to mix it up, but he's ready to mix it up. Don't push him, right? But then there's other times where he talks in this much more like, "You so brave now," you know, where is that like a Grimlock kind of thing they're doing with him? Or are they trying to make him more of like a barbarian warrior kind of heavy? What was that all about?
Mm-hmm.
So it's not 100% clear what the intention was with the character, but like you can just put him under the broad classification of heavy thug character. Yeah. It's interesting that I feel like he got more screen time than I think the other two of the Coneheads. And at times it feels like he's kind of the leader. Like even the way he says, "Stop it, Dirge. There's nothing here but sand and more sand."
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think he's in season 3 a little bit. And it, again, he's like sort of the boss of the Coneheads kind of thing. So that's surprising given that he really, everything about him feels like he's just meant to be sort of hired muscle for the team. So if they would have amped that up more, amped up the fact that he's not that bright, but he likes to mix things up, put him with Lurch from the Addams Family, and then our third character, which we'll talk about in a minute. I feel like if you were to turn that volume up in the sun, what we're used to getting from Sunbow, it would have probably made these characters like super memorable, even if they weren't better than the original Seekers, if they just would have turned up these personality traits a little bit more, because we're kind of left kind of scratching our head and squinting at the TV going like, well, I think he's this. I don't know.
Yeah. Again, I think it's a missed opportunity, but
you did have the toy though.
Yeah. He and Thrust were ones that I got from my neighbor again. Okay. So I never bought them myself, but I got them in trade. So that's how I had five Seekers for the longest time in my collection.
Looking back, I would have to say that I coveted Starscream very dearly, and I never had him as a child. Didn't get him until the early 2000s were releases. Skywarp I got for my 13th birthday, and that was a high moment for me. That was like, oh my gosh, it's Skywarp. I never thought I'd see him. I'm 13 now, right? He's been off the shelves for like a year. You might as well have gone back to like the dinosaur era to get this toy. But I don't remember ever feeling like, I don't remember me going up to mom and dad and saying like, I gotta have Thrust. I gotta have Ramjet. You know, It's like, they were just on the show. They were fine. But I didn't feel any desire to have the toys, even though they had cool new wings. Mm-hmm. So that's interesting too. That's telling.
Yeah. Even though I love the Decepticons, I was pretty much the same way. It's like, oh, there's more Decepticons to get. And In contrast, it's like those two I got through a trade, but Astrotrain and Blitzwing I specifically asked for and got. So I purchased those, or my parents purchased those. So the Season 2 Seekers, just they were just sort of like whatever, you know.
Yeah.
They didn't stand out that much to a kid, unfortunately.
At least not to these two kids.
Yeah. So that leads us to Thrust, who's voiced by Ed Gilbert.
We had not counted on Power Glide's interference.
And read you this bit from his tech spec. It says, he rattles the air with the roar of his jets, believes half the battle is won if the opponent is psyched out by his mere arrival, so he makes no attempt to be sneaky. Pompous, loudmouth braggart, and not too brave. Sudden powerful accelerations can topple nearby buildings. So that's interesting. I mean, it's a very typical bad guy. He's pompous. Yeah. So he's a braggart. Okay. So he's basically, I guess, like Skywarp turned up to 11, maybe?
Yeah, I would say Skywarp, but maybe a little bit more manic.
Yeah.
Right? Like, Skywarp's got a sense of kind of, like, coolness about him.
Yeah, like, Skywarp doesn't, I wouldn't call Skywarp a braggart. Like, Skywarp doesn't necessarily feel the need to talk about how good he is or things like that. But they're going that direction.
Yep. So what do you think about the interpretation of him in the cartoon?
I feel it's fairly accurate, but again, it's like we just don't see it a whole lot. I mean, there's the Golden Lagoon where he finds the Golden Lagoon and he thinks this is going to get him in good with Megatron and everything. So I can see how that reflects the braggart in him, but he says he's not too brave and he has a courage of 4, which is just like Dirge.
And that tracks with the God Gambit, where he's like, Astrotrain, Autobots!
Right.
It's like, oh, it's Cosmos.
Yeah. And he has an intelligence of 6, which just puts him 1 score up from Ramjet, but still 2 down from Dirge. So, I mean, he just comes off as, again, another thug, yet another thug in the Decepticon ranks. And This one is a braggart. I mean, he just seems like, I don't know, it's like he fell out of Grease or something, the musical Grease. He's just kind of like a leather jacket wearing thug.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, there's not too much more to him than that.
It's fascinating to me that with a character like Power Glide, you can have him like it's unambiguous that Power Glide looks in the mirror and says, all right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. How do you know? He's telling you all the time. He talks about himself in the third person. You know, like, watch the old Power Glide pow, that kind of thing.
Yep.
Okay, do that with Thrust. Show us a scene where he walks in and we understand that he looks in the mirror and says, only a god could put this together.
Yeah.
Right? And have the other Decepticons be like, ugh, about it.
Yeah, it just seems like that wasn't on the agenda. It's like, no, if we really want to dive into the character, it's going to be an Autobot. You know, it's like, because those are the ones that the kids are paying attention to.
You know, and that's a drag because I have a lot more powerful feelings for season one Decepticons than season two Decepticons because of this.
Yeah. I mean, I think as a whole, they're definitely not doing as good a job with the characterization in season two as they were in season one. But again, the sheer number of characters, you got to kind of understand that they're going to buckle under the weight of all this work.
Yeah. Yep. I think that's exactly right.
They can't really spend all their time differentiating Thrust from Ramjet and things like that. So again, we understand why it's flawed. It's just sort of sad that it's flawed. We're not saying, oh, we would have done a better job in their shoes. We're not arrogant. I mean, come on. It's just sad that things were so rushed and these things were glazed over and missed. It's just sort of, it's a missed opportunity and it's sort of sad.
Yeah.
But so anything else about the Coneheads? I mean, they are disappointing to me, but I do still find that I like them.
Yeah, I do too. I mean, I don't want anybody to misunderstand me and think that I don't like that I dislike the Coneheads. Mm-hmm. I like them. And Thrust in particular, I actually had Thrust because of a trade. It was one of those things where a kid and I traded for like a week or something like that. So I had Thrust for a while, and I did think that like the new wings on the Seekers was kind of cool, and like the fact that Thrust had like fan jets on his wings, so like he could probably be like VTOL, right? Yeah. Just take off from a standing position. That's awesome. I remember liking the character okay in the show, but I think the problem is that as I watch it now, it's clear to me why I didn't feel a huge desire to have them. And I can see very clearly how you could have made 11-year-old me not be able to live without them. Because if you did a scene where Thrust like not only walked into a room, but like strutted into a room, maybe singing his own theme song.
Right.
Maybe he's got like a little Thrust song that he sings. And like as he passes by, you have Skywarp turn to Thundercracker's like, and I thought Starscream was bad, you know, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
That alone would have been like, oh, wow, Thrust, there's something to this character. So unfortunately, I feel like in The Girl Who Loved Powerglide, which we talked about very recently, the three of them as thugs and heavies totally worked in the context of that story, but Thrust has been in a number of episodes.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't get a whole lot. I think we got a lot of him giving the Autobots a hard time, but that feels very generic when it's just right. A Decepticon taunting an Autobot. You got to have a scene where we see him interacting with other Decepticons in that braggart way. He never does. So that's a drag.
Yeah, and that was just kind of a failing at the time. It would take them a lot longer, like around the time of R.I.D. in 2001, to realize that, and again, that was a Japanese show that they brought over, so it almost kind of forced them to talk about the Decepticons and the Predacons, because, you know, they had these much bigger roles, and you got a lot of scenes of Skybite just sort of like talking to himself about, you know, how he felt about things. You know, Skybite was just always talking about anything.
Which we spent so much time talking about whenever Skybite would have like this imaginary moment where a super deformed Scourge would give a super deformed Megatron everything he ever wanted. Like, Skybite failed, so I gave you all of the Autobots. And then like the super deformed Megatron would be like, oh, well done, Scourge. And it'd cut back to Skybite who's like stomping and literally crying. Tears are coming out of his eyes while he's thinking about how Scourge does everything better than him.
Yeah, now just imagine a Generation 1 cartoon where the Decepticons were allowed to have that sort of character and character moments and screen time.
Yeah.
I mean, you got Starscream screen time, of course.
Yeah.
But move on. There's other characters. It doesn't always have to be about Starscream.
Totally. Yeah. The dynamic is changing too, which we'll talk about at the end of this one. Like the overall dynamic of the series and how the Decepticons' worldview is fundamentally flawed, I feel like, has changed quite a bit since season one. But we got a few more Decepticons to get through. I am curious to hear what you think about Astrotrain.
Yep, that brings us to the Triple Changers, and Astrotrain is voiced by Jack Angel as well.
These fools worship Transformers. If I claim to be their supreme god, they will bow to the Decepticons.
And the interesting bits from his tech spec says, creating confusion is his specialty. Thrives on foes' panic and fear. And I feel that kind of comes into play in the God Gambit, where he's sort of stepping in to rule these flesh creatures. You know, he's confusing them by portraying himself as a god, and he's thriving on their panic that this god is angry at them.
Well, he's the first Transformer we hear say the word die in the series.
Mm-hmm.
All who oppose me, die. So, yeah, I guess that's thriving on panic and fear.
As far as stats go, they gave him an intelligence of 7, which is pretty high, but it's not Dirge's 8. And they gave him a courage of 7 and a skill of 8. So these are pretty high numbers for your typical Decepticon. Usually a Decepticon fails in some area and they get a low score. But as far as stats go, those are pretty good. So you could see why Astrotrain comes in knowing things, and you could see why he would want to take down Megatron. So I feel like they did a good job adapting his tech specs. But again, you know, you have Triple Takeover where he gets the opportunity to be the boss, and all he does is he gets trains to do stuff and not very well. Yeah. So it's like you have this smart guy show up. He shows up after Megatron has already been established as leader. So you can see how he might see himself in that position. He doesn't necessarily have the history with Megatron that these other characters do. And he's basically given the green light to do his own thing. And he just spends it messing around with trains. And it's just really another missed opportunity. And it's like they felt they had to sort of nerf all the Decepticons in this show other than Megatron. Because they couldn't have anyone super intelligent possibly take over as leader because Megatron was just too good. And that sounds like something I would like. But I don't think you need to nerf the other Decepticons in order to have that happen.
What I'm reminded of is a story about the writing of the Dungeons & Dragons cartoon, where I think Eric is the character's name. He's the one with the shield played by Donnie Most, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he's the Starscream of the heroes in that series, in that he's always contradicting the leader, and he's always kind of bad-mouthing everything that's happening. He's always complaining. And he often will go off on his own path. Like, you guys can go do this plan.
Right.
I'm going to go over here. And then he falls in a mud puddle or he gets into, like, bigger trouble of some kind. And that was actually, like, mandated to Mark Evanier, the writer of the series, that always show that when Eric is leaving the group, that he's wrong to do it. Right? Which is, like, it points to something, like, potentially kind of nefarious if you think a little bit more about it, right? It kind of reminds me of that G.I. Joe episode where, like, Duke shuts off the TV because the likables are on. Like, only if everybody thinks alike can there be world peace. And Duke's like, oh my God. So I'm thinking about, like, I wonder if this is a situation where some other force got in the room and said, we can't show the villains as being too capable. We have to show that the malfunction of their worldview is that not only do they bicker amongst themselves, but they have very limited worldview. Like, one of the things we covered in Triple Takeover was that I thought it was interesting that it feels like it's a story loosely about what happens when somebody with a lack of vision suddenly finds themselves in a position of power. Mm-hmm. And if they don't have the ability to do the proper perspective taking to understand what the implications of power are, and this is like how the Decepticons' worldview is fundamentally wrong, they're going to wind up just replicating themselves. What does Astrotrain do? He just, like, makes more of himself, going, well, that's what an army is. I'm awesome, so I'm just going to make more of that. Not thinking about, like, well, you're actually just making, like, copies of copies, and they're less than you. And what's more is you need more voices in the room. You need to hear from more perspectives in order to, like, really guide and govern and lead. What does Blitzwing do? He trusts an advisor that he didn't even properly vet. He's like, you seem like you're competent. Tell me what to do. I'm just going to trust you implicitly instead of actually, like, thinking through my ideas and questions. So you got these two characters who have very limited perspectives. Suddenly they have the power to do things. And of course it implodes on them because they can't grow beyond their own limited worldview. And I feel like their file cards don't point to that. So it feels like it's like one of those things where it's like, well, we can't show them being too capable. We can't show them being too correct in the world. They have to be so fundamentally wrong. There's no questioning that they're wrong. Whereas I feel like in season one, there was enough ambiguity. Like the fact that the first two miniseries, for crying out loud, Megatron wins by a substantial margin up until the last moment of the series. Like he's always 10 steps ahead of Optimus, and not just Megatron, but all the Decepticons. They're all super capable. and they all are, relatively speaking, very organized, except for Starscream. That was the first observation we made, was that this tyrannical organization, its weakest link is that the one individualist can blow up the whole plan. Now, everybody's an individualist, but they're all fundamentally broken people. I don't know how explicit that idea was explored in the writing room about this, but what it results in is it does make all of the characters seem kind of dumb. Like, not dumb, like, dumb as in, like, I don't like them. I think that they're dumb ideas. It means that they all come across
as unintelligent. They don't know what they're
doing. Yes.
They can't succeed in anything.
Right. Whereas I feel like that's getting very granular about something that could be explored in a larger way with the Decepticons as a whole. And that's where we came to this observation that we were talking about in a recent episode, where I wonder if this, whether it was implicit or explicit, this idea of brain drain as being a natural result of tyrannical rule. If you run your organization like a tyrant and nobody has say, it's going to be hard to keep the really talented people on board because they don't feel like they have any skin in the game. And so you're going to get like a lot of dum-dums in your organization over time. And I feel like that's where when we're heading to season three, we really get to that point. But I don't know, again, if that was intentional. At the very least, it feels inconsistent with what the toys' tech specs were saying. So, yeah Astrotrain feels inconsistent in the series, because in God Gambit, he seems pretty capable. Mm-hmm. And he has vision. In Triple Takeover, he suffers from a severe lack of vision.
Yeah.
So I don't remember having any real strong feelings about Astrotrain as a whole. But I do remember thinking he was intimidating and intense in the God Gambit. But after that, he really just becomes the transport vehicle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In the Gambler, that's pointed out pretty clearly. It's like, they get to go have all the fun while I have to sit here.
Yeah.
So it's a bummer. I would have liked to see, I don't know how I would do Triple Takeover any different, Hoover, because I feel like the idea behind it is actually pretty solid. It's just that it would be finding a way to tie it more into some kind of like genuine personality difference between Astrotrain and Blitzwing.
Mm-hmm. And Starscream, because he was stereotypically the guy who wanted to take over. So you don't want to portray Astrotrain as the new guy who wants to take over, because Starscream's still in the show.
Mm-hmm.
So it just seems a little mixed up as far as like their portrayal and not necessarily entirely consistent along the season.
Yeah. And you had the toy, right?
Yeah, I had Astrotrain and Blitzwing both. I think they were Christmas presents, I want to see. Maybe birthday presents, but I feel like I got them for Christmas 1 year.
Mm.
So that was probably 85.
He was another one that I did like a week-long trade with another kid in school. And I remember the first time I turned into robot mode and I saw those little arms. I was like, oh, that's okay. I'm not super excited about this toy. He's cool. I mean, like, he's heavy because he's like, a lot of him is made of die-cast metal. But the design of the toy was like, it's okay. It's fine. I do have him now. I got him in that awesome deal when I got Omega Supreme at that comic book and collectible store. But it was another one of the things where it's like, yeah, I guess I'll take Astrotrain. I mean, he's only $5 or whatever I paid for him. So. But it wasn't like, oh my gosh, at long last, I have Astrotrain.
Right.
So, but the next one, Blitzwing, I forgot until we started doing the notes for this one. I did get Blitzwing in the box for Christmas 1 year. Mm. I actually had the toy.
Hmm. Well, Blitzwing is voiced by Ed Gilbert.
No one fools Blitzwing. You are a great military strategist. You will be my second in command.
And judging by his tech specs, there is not even much on the tech specs to go by. I mean, there's a lot of that sort of, he can go this miles per hour and everything, but who cares? I mean, numbers are important to kids. I understand that. As a kid, it sounds important to say how fast he can go. That's fine. But as me being an old person now, the only thing that stands out in his tech specs is he says he has a cruel sense of humor. He's loud-mouthed, belligerent, and brash. So, again, that's sort of generic villain. That's basically what they just said for Thrust. Yeah.
He's not nice. Watch out.
Oh, surprising.
Oh, he's singing that song Pluto sang in Popeye the Movie. I mean, you know what I mean. Yeah, okay, well, now we know all we need to know about you.
And he has similar stats to Astrotrain, but his intelligence is 5 rather than Astrotrain's 7. His courage is also 7, which is equal to Astrotrain's, but his skill is 7 as opposed to Astrotrain's 8. So he's just slightly less competent, and he's obviously typical bad guy. He's loudmouthed and cruel. So, okay. You know, again, we don't see a whole lot of him. We see him the most in Triple Takeover, and obviously he's showing that 5 intelligence there where he thinks a football coach can be a good manager or leader. And I can't mention these guys without mentioning that I think it was a huge missed opportunity to not explain why they have 3 modes.
Yeah.
Come on. That was a whole new thing for the Transformers, and it would continue into the next season with new triple changers, and they never explain why they're that way.
There would be a really good reason to explain why Astrotrain and Blitzwing felt like they could take over the Decepticons if they were a new species of Transformer that has 3 modes.
Mm-hmm.
That alone, right there. Yeah. If you take the Decepticon worldview, that might makes right. Power is the only absolute. That's the only measurement of the rights to anything. I have more power, quote unquote, than you. Therefore, step aside, Megatron. What do you turn into? Oh, you turn into a gun. That's nice, but somebody has to wield you. I turn into a tank. Step aside, right? They have so much reason to be arrogant. So if you just even started Triple Takeover from that perspective, the disdain they express for Starscream at the beginning of that episode is pretty there. It's Astrotrain has that great line with like no planet ever fell out of its orbit, overestimating the stupidity of Starscream. So we got it that they look down on them, but like let's bring the whole fact that they're a different species into it, because that's also something that feels like would fit with a broken Decepticon worldview. Is that what makes us different is what is worth exploring and sorting ourselves into buckets with, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that could have been cool, and we could have actually gotten some explanation on that. Even if it would have been like, oh, okay, there was this Cybertron colony from like 12 million years ago. They went off and, you know what, they found out they could find a third mode. Boom. Mm-hmm. Now you got a backstory. It's explained and explains why they suddenly feel like they have the right to be in charge. We've come back for our birthright, you know?
Yeah. I mean, when these came out, it was portrayed as a big deal, because the idea of a robot to change into something else was only like 2 years old for us Americans at this point.
Yeah.
So now we're getting a third mode. Well, that's interesting, and it's fascinating that a toy can look good in 3 different modes. But how about a little backstory as to why this huge mythos-expanding thing is a thing?
Yeah.
And, you know, I just view it that they were too rushed. Thankfully, as these next 10 episodes will show, they did give some of these other new concepts, like the combiner concept. They gave it episodes to explain and everything, but we didn't get anything for triple changers, and I think that would be one of the main things that I would fix in G1 if I could fix anything.
Wow, that's a big statement.
It just seems so obvious that, you know, oh, well, we'll get the explanation of these guys. No, we won't.
So actually, now that I think about it, because I was thinking about your problems with Heavy Metal War, but like, at least there was a rationalization that was available through analysis of like throwaway dialogue, right?
Yeah.
Whereas with the triple changers, there's nothing. They're just there.
Nothing.
And
yep.
Nobody draws attention to it. I remember, again, so we're to keep comparing this to other iterations of the series, perhaps unfairly, but in Robots in Disguise 2001, when we meet our first combiner, which is Rail Racer, you know, they take a moment to go to the Autobot brothers, Sideburn, Prowl, and Xbrawn, and like, whoa, those guys can combine? And like, I wonder if we can combine? And they're like, yeah, I don't want to combine with you. And it becomes this cute little, like, character moment.
Mm-hmm.
But it at least drew attention to the fact that this was special, that they do that, you know? We never got that with these guys. They show up and they're doing... Now, I want to back up because I know somebody's going to... A very careful listener is going to say, but Jersey, you made a lot of noise in an earlier episode about how you don't need everything explained for you and you like the whimsy of it. I do. But this is also an opportunity to go into some bananas world building like Alpha Trion and come up with some wild idea of, wait a second, there's a whole branch of Transformers development that happened off of Cybertron or something like that, to where these characters have three forms instead of two. That's notable. So I would have liked, even if it was just a line of dialogue, just to conjure this more sprawling, deeper mythology that doesn't have to have everything tied together for me, but suggest wildness to it. And then I would get excited.
Yeah.
So again, we'll point in another series. What Animated did with him was actually pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm.
They took this idea of like, what would happen if you had more than one form? Well, maybe that'd be kind of chaotic. Maybe it'd be kind of weird because like you wouldn't know what's the real you. Ah, so we'll come up with this idea of he has three personalities based on the different modes. Oh, I love that idea. And that introduced more of that kind of wild speculation and like don't explain everything, but like hint at a lot of cool stuff that made that series so much fun for me.
Yeah.
But then he shows up and he's just like, I mean, okay, well.
Yeah.
I think your toy is cool. And then we don't even really get a lot. Like, he shows up in other times and he's just like, I'm here to be mean. Okay, well, here's your mean character for today. Triple Takeover, we get this interesting little inflection where he's like trusting the coach and everything and thanking him dearly. And then in season three, when he shows up again, the last time we see him in season three, he's like a totally different character altogether. So I feel like there weren't any consistent notes being kept on who Blitzwing is. That's another thing that I feel like is kind of visible in season two.
Yeah. And that just brings us to the point where there was a very visceral feeling that these episodes were being pumped out.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them that could have referenced one another did not. And it just seems like there was an army of people working on these things in their own homes, you know, not really collaborating with people and then just turning them in. So season two, huge rush. So you have to sort of give all the problems it has a pass because you know why they're happening. It's just unfortunate that it's like that.
I think some language we've used a lot in this season's wrap-ups is early draft.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of these episodes feel like they're early drafts that didn't get as much revision as they might have needed or as much careful attention to continuity, even within the episode. Like when you have plots referred to that you never know what the plot is. Megatron's doing something, making people build buildings with under hypnotic control. What's the building do? I don't know, but we'll destroy it. Or we blew up the film can, but we didn't blow up the film can. Mm-hmm. Now we got to go after the film can. What?
Yeah, I think that episode of all of them is the most obvious that, okay, you may have only had a weekend to finish this, didn't you?
So, on the one hand, I'm torn on how I feel about this because, like, something I'm feeling right now that I don't want to say I'm feeling tired of, but I'm noticing it is that because I watch modern kids' cartoons. I stay on this stuff not only because I work with children and it's good to be able to speak to characters that they're familiar with rather than, you know, talk about Generation 1 Transformers, which, like, maybe 2% of the room is going to be familiar with. But also because I like watching these cartoons, like the new Big City Greens, Amphibia, We Bare Bears, all these new cartoons that are more recent. They, almost every one of them, are following this formula where it's a funny standalone episode, but at the end of every episode, there's a hint of a developing seasonal arc. Kind of what we got in Beast Wars, which made us so electrified. Like, oh my gosh, they're building to something, and there's going to be a season finale where there's a major cliffhanger, and now we got to wait 4 months before we watch another episode? You got to be kidding me, you know?
Yeah.
That was so exciting at the time, but now I feel like every kid's cartoon is doing that. They all have some kind of, like, B story that's rotating in and out of the standalone episodes, which is kind of, I'm feeling a little tired and taxed by it because it's almost to say, like, you better not miss an episode. If you miss an episode when there's the payoff at the season's end, you're not going to... We ran into this with the superhero TV shows, Supergirl, Legends of Tomorrow, where it was like, you got to watch everything in order to understand the big crossover event at the end of the season. I'm like, I don't have that kind of time. I'm sorry. I love these characters, but I'm not making a part-time job out of following your show. And I know 16-year-old, maybe they have that time. I don't even know if they do. My point is that this season, as I'm revisiting it, I feel like it's so refreshing to engage with a cartoon where there's a standalone episode and I don't have to watch any more to understand anything that happened in that one. Events of this episode have no bearing on what happens at the end of the season. So I can bip in, enjoy it, and walk away. Right? So that feels refreshing. On the other hand, without any focus, you get these things like where Blitzwing's just like, he's mean. Well, we could have developed it more, but really, like, everybody was writing their scripts at home and we didn't have like a group meeting. Zoom didn't exist at the time, so we couldn't all get together to talk about it. You know? So you lose a sense of focus, you gain a more relaxed way to watch, and you also gain like something about like these seasonal arcs nowadays. I almost feel like it's a little too precious. It's a little too there's a little bit too much bated breath sometimes for me. And maybe that's more of a reflection of like my sense of how much time I have and like the urgency with which I attend all the things in my life. But I do appreciate, like, there's a cartoon from like 10 years ago called Chowder. I don't know if you ever watched that, Hoover. It was a cartoon.
I was aware of it, but I never watched it.
Oh my gosh, I love it so much. It's such a good show. And it's just a bunch of short stories. They don't build on anything. There's no big payoff at the end of the season. You just watch a bunch of fun stories about these characters that you love. And like, I was reminded of that when I was watching this. I'm like, oh, I get to enjoy Power Glide and then I get to walk away. Oh, there's a two-parter? Cool. Well, I'll check in for 42 minutes and then I'll walk away, you know? So I don't know. I'm ambivalent on it. I wonder how you feel about this. Like, especially when we think about like the lens of Beast Wars of what that afforded the Transformers.
Yeah. I mean, that was really fascinating and I loved it at the time. But I wouldn't necessarily want that for G1. You know, I feel as long as you make the characters loud, you don't have to have, like, the plot ramping up slowly through the episodes. Like, I don't need a big Generation 1 cliffhanger or anything like that. I like the way Beast Wars did it. I was a huge fan of it. And I love it, and I wouldn't have it any other way. But I don't think that every series needs to be that. With Beast Wars, it was the first new Transformers show in a while, so they had full reason to reinvent themselves and everything. So that was fine, and I certainly enjoyed it and absolutely love Beast Wars. But I don't need that sort of thing in Generation 1. Just, I would like it to be more consistent. But I don't need, like, a big ramp up to some sort of big surprise ending like we got in Beast Wars. It's just not necessary.
Yeah.
But I would like more consistency of character and consistency of plot. Like, to go from Megatron almost winning through some sort of energy takeover to switch up to Hoist starring in a movie, it's a bit too much of a range, I think.
Yeah.
So
I can see that.
So I guess, you know, I would certainly go in and fine tune it, but you know, as we say, it is what it is.
Yeah. Yep. I think you said it well when it was like you can really smell the churn. Like they were just cranking the stuff out and all doing it in their own corners. And so it came back feeling very much spaghetti at the wall kind of thing.
Yeah. And again, not to be overly negative, I mean, it's amazing that this show is as good as it is. Yep. I mean, we put it on each week, and for the most part, we're pleased with it. Yep. So they did a good job. We're just cognizant of the fact that they could have done a better job if they had been given more time and resources and everything. But, you know, again, that's not their fault. We're not judging them for it.
No, I will say this again and again, is that these people were taking it seriously. They had their hearts in it. Nobody is going to tell me that Wally Burr didn't care about the performance of these characters, right? He read the scripts. He read the tech specs. He knew what he wanted in that room. And all the voice actors talk about that when they talk about Wally Burr. So they're all doing their level best. I don't think any of this was being hacked. I just think that, as we've explored, the pressures of all the forces. And that's, I think that's part of like, was the inspiration for the show, is really exploring how the pressures of a toy company saying, talk about these toys so we can make money. And the pressures of you know, writers trying to get these things done in time to do 50 something odd episodes in one season, and then animators, all the different levels of production, voice actors, you put all that together, you're going to come up with these wonderful, weird inconsistencies, strange, odd bits of storytelling that sometimes demand explanation. And you're going to get these shining moments where it all sort of lines up exactly the right way. And then you get these lines, these bits of storytelling that like somehow lodge themselves in there in the back of our brain, and we can recite them by heart 25 years, 35 years later.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like I said before, it's amazing that this show was as great as it is and that it's so memorable, because it was not made to be remembered 30 odd years later. That's not what they were shooting for.
That's very true. That's a good piece of perspective to hold on to. They were just trying to ship some toys. So the fact that we're even still talking about it is something. So, oh man, I feel like this was a good break before diving into what's probably going to be an intense 10 episodes for us.
Yeah, these next 10, there's a lot of common ground between them, as we'll see. We'll see a lot of new characters pop up. So we're going to talk about them as they go. Our next episode is The Key to Vector Sigma, Part 1. Mm. And that is Season 2, Episode 39 on Tubi. So it's another two-parter. And I'll let you know, we're going to be introduced to a lot of new characters in this two-parter.
And some very, very memorable ones, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Even though we don't get a lot of them in the whole series overall, but very memorable. All right, I'm looking forward to watching it and talking about it with you. So this is the part where I say to everybody who's listening, if you don't want your tech spec to read cruel sense of humor, loud mouth, belligerent, and brash, go to wherever you listen to the show and give us a 5-star review. That's the antidote to having a reductive, mean person review on your tech spec. You'll get something a little bit more subtle and nuanced after that. Thanks to everybody who gives us a 5-star review wherever you listen to us. It means a lot to us. And if you want to evoke the weirdness, the cosmic oddity of Alpha Trion on Cybertron, if you want to be the Obi-Wan Kenobi of the Autobots, you'll write a review. Just write a few sentences. I'm not even going to tell you what to write this time. Usually I give you like a little structure to it. But just like, what's the first thing that comes to mind when you think of this podcast? Just say that. And that's good. And then it'll help more people find the show. Anything else that people should do, Hoover, if they really enjoy what we do here?
We have a TeePublic site, teepublic.com/user/4 million years later. And that has some funny little designs on it. Take a look at those. You can get them as stickers. You can get them as pretty much anything you want.
Hmm. Exciting. So they're linked on the website too, 4millionyearslater.com. Mm-hmm. Speaking of which, we record the show weekly. It drops on Thursdays at 4millionyearslater.com and in podcatchers everywhere. Thank you, Hoover, for this discussion. Thanks, everybody, for downloading and listening. And until next time, I've been Jersey Drozd of 4millionyearslater.com and Jersey Drozd on Instagram.
I've been Hoover.
Okay, bye.
Goodbye.
Episode synopses are from imdb.com and some episode information taken from tfwiki.net. The closing theme is by Nick Mihalik, based on the original closing theme by Ford Kinder and Ann Bryant. You can find more of Nick's music at soundcloud.com/Nicholas-Mihalik.
That's spelled NICHOLAS-MEHALIC.
Find us on Facebook under 4 Million Years Later, and you can email us at 4millionyearslater@gmail.com.
Visit 4millionyearslater.com, and if you haven't yet, please subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts. You know how it works.